Welcome to Asia Pacific Defense Reporter, your go-to source for cutting-edge security insights in the region. Get ready for rapid-fire analysis and commentary from the Asia Pacific with your host, Kim Bergman.
Hello and welcome back. Let's start off with a piece of good news, and that is that Defense Minister Richard Marles has announced during a visit to Ukraine, itself a positive development, that Australia will contribute another $100 million in military aid. $100 million is a helpful package, but I have to say, once again, for a country with the world's 12th largest economy, that's Australia, it really isn't very much in the scheme of things. I don't want to sound ungrateful, but personally I would prefer a figure of around $500 million to start really making a significant difference. And that would bring us back into line with some other contributors to Ukraine, such as Japan. And by the way, that amount does not expunge Army's guilt or this government's guilt for the willful destruction of $1 billion worth of Taipan helicopters that right now should be on their way to that country. Looking at the replacement Black Hawk helicopters, does anyone know how many are currently operational? My guess is zero. Now, a few words about the unfolding disaster of the General Purpose Frigate competition. Usually the huge mistakes of defence only become public with failures during a project, things such as the Sea Sprite helicopters and the Army's battle management systems. Failures, which, by the way, can almost always be traced back to defence itself. But some other projects are doomed from the start. And I have the attack-class submarines in mind, where Navy pushed for a retro design, staunchly refusing to consider modern features such as air-independent propulsion and lithium-ion batteries. And I think that the general-purpose frigate is in the same category. And the fatal flaw is the government's concept of minimum viable capability. This means taking whatever you can get and rushing it into service because we have been too collectively lazy to do our jobs, and there is a huge looming capability gap that was actually apparent about 5 years ago. Now, this government, quite correctly, holds the coalition responsible because they were running the place for the critical 10-year period when a number of key decisions were not taken. However, Marles and company are also to blame because they've been in power for a while, and they are responsible for agreeing to follow the recommendation in the Defence Strategic Review that a separate study was needed into the surface fleet. There was no need for that. They could have just said to the DSR team, no, it's your job, you do it. But no, they instead agreed to the separate review. That took another 6 months. And then, unconscionably, the government itself sat on that review for 6 months on top of that. And by the way, the premise of that additional review was that nuclear-powered submarines changed the whole equation when it came to anti-submarine warfare, and that premise was then completely ignored in the actual report itself and also the government's response to it, which really makes one wonder, once again, why it was necessary in the first place. As I say, we have already blown the whistle on the embarrassingly poor start to this program, with neither the independent team responsible for the review or dozens of people in Navy and the Department of Defence who read it and agreed with it. All of them were unable to understand that when they listed the Korean FFX Batch 2 and Batch 3 design, it is actually two widely different designs. It's a childish error, and it comes from people who have been paid millions, possibly tens of millions of taxpayer dollars in salaries and consulting fees. Anyway, this might well come to a head this week, because in Canberra there will be one of the regular 2+2 meetings with South Korea. That's to the defence minister and the foreign minister from each country. In the normal course of events, it could be expected that the South Koreans would politely seek clarification about whether one or two of their designs are in the running, and if it's only one, which one is it that will be evaluated? Perfectly reasonable questions. My own suspicion, though, is that this project is already cursed by such a level of bungling that Australian officials will have warned off their South Korean counterparts, saying under no circumstances must this issue be raised because it would embarrass the ministers since we are at a delicate point, or some other such palpable nonsense. Anyway, we'll find out quite soon whether I'm right or wrong. A thing which has been in the news a bit recently, and again, I touched on it in the last podcast, is plans to somehow revitalize manufacturing in Australia, announced by the Prime Minister, some details to come in the forthcoming budget. And I hear you once again thinking, well, what has this got to do with defence? Well, just bear with me for a moment. Anyway, a big component of this manufacturing idea is that Australia should be producing solar panels of our own. And that's caused a bit of a fuss. All of the focus seems to have been on China. At least that's as far as the ABC is concerned and the Australian newspaper. I haven't carried out an exhausting survey of all of the media, but both of them seem to have worked themselves up into a bit of a frenzy about dependence on China and things like that. But let's have another one of my little quizzes. And hopefully in a moment, you'll see what I'm driving at. So, which company is the number one supplier of solar panels to Australia? Any guesses? No? Well, it's a company called Hanwha. And where is Hanwha from? Hint, it's not China. They are a South Korean company. How do we know the name Hanwha? Well, you'd certainly know it from listening to these podcasts and reading Asia Pacific Defense Reporter, because they have the contracts to supply the army with Huntsman self-propelled howitzers and Redback infantry fighting vehicles from their new facility near Geelong. How else do we know the name? Because a few weeks ago, they announced a bid for Austal in Western Australia, and even though the bid has been rejected, it shows their willingness to invest in Australia. So, don't you think it would be sensible for a government to actually do its homework and maybe speak to Hanwha about the feasibility of the Australian manufacture of solar panels? Don't you think that they would be in a good position to help? Another domain where South Korea could help, and by the way, I've been on something of a 14-year crusade as a journalist to try and make people wake up to the fact that South Korea not only has enormous manufacturing capability, but they have this willingness, this amazing willingness to help Australia. I can go into the reasons why in another podcast. Another domain where South Korea could help, apart from naval shipbuilding that I've highlighted now in a couple of podcasts, is in the domestic production of guided weapons. You know, the things that the guided weapons and explosive ordnance enterprise has about $4 billion of funds available to develop. South Korea embarked on their own version of guided weapons enterprise about 20 years ago and now produce domestically many things such as torpedoes, air defense missiles, all the way through to submarine-launched ballistic missiles. And as a nation, they would be more than happy to share the knowledge of what works and what doesn't. Yes, we tried this, it didn't work, we still have to import these solutions. On the other hand, these ones worked really well and you don't need a big manufacturing base, blah, blah, blah. The level of interest from Australia, frankly, as far as I can tell, it's zero. In an early podcast, I mentioned the willingness of Hanwha, and I know this is now sounding like a paid commercial, to transfer all of the technology for their Chunmoo multiple launch rocket system to Australia. That's everything, including the most important element, the guided rockets themselves, because Hanwha do the lot. It's a sort of fully vertically integrated solution. Now, that's not to denigrate the efforts of Lockheed Martin, which will start to manufacture some basic GMLRS rockets next year. But it sounds like it will initially be the assembly of fully imported kits from the United States, which isn't really adding to defense self-reliance. If we had consulted with the South Koreans, we would be, in my opinion, a lot further advanced along the road to having a really powerful sovereign indigenous capability. Let me see, what else has been in the news? There was an excellent 60 Minutes segment about a fortnight ago on the Taipan helicopters, and particularly the fatal Lindemann Island crash last year during Exercise Talisman Sabre. I urge everyone to view it. It's available online. In essence, the program suggests that the crash might have been caused by the pilot becoming disoriented due to a faulty display in the helmet-mounted vision system. This is known as Top Owl. It's in service with about 15 operators, including the US Marine Corps. But, of course, the Australian Army has tweaked their solution so that it's different from all of the others. The subtext, by the way, of the program is, as we have been arguing, that the helicopters themselves are absolutely fine. So let's think about the timeline. Before the fatal crash, Army had plans to store the helicopters at Townsville Airport to figure out a long-term strategy for their disposal. But after the crash, Army and the government were in a completely insane rush to dismantle them and bury their remains. Is there a connection between the two events? Well, possibly there is. We just don't know enough because, of course, we have this continuing culture of total secrecy. Changing topics now to another obsession, nuclear-powered submarines. And I've spoken previously about the willingness of very senior US officials to make themselves available to the international media. It's a great system, and it's in stark comparison with our own people who would rather literally hide under a rock than have any meaningful direct engagement with a journalist. Last week, I had a chance to put a question to Bonnie Jenkins. She is the Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security Affairs. And again, compliments to the US State Department for setting these things up. Now, I put in a question in advance, which in retrospect might have been a mistake. I asked about how the $4.7 billion Australian dollar contribution to AUKUS was calculated. And the answer from her, this is a quote, "So the $3 billion in US dollar Australian contribution will uplift the US submarine industrial base and provide enduring benefits to US Virginia class submarine construction and maintenance efforts. The contribution by Australia to the US submarine industrial base will build on existing and planned US efforts that will improve industrial base capability, will increase capacity, it'll grow workforce and advance new manufacturing technologies." There you go. That was the answer. Rather formulaic, I'd have to say, and very, very similar to the answers that Australian officials give during Senate estimates hearings, and indeed answers given to me by Richard Miles and Pat Conroy. So I've asked for clarification again, though, on how the $4.7 billion was calculated. And to my mild surprise and disappointment, the US State Department declined to provide an answer. They've given me an email point of contact in the Pentagon, so I've sent through a question, and we'll wait and see whether there's an answer. And this, for me, is an area of both personal and professional frustration and dissatisfaction. And I sometimes wonder, am I the only person that actually cares about how this gigantic figure was actually arrived at? All of my colleagues in the media, many of them friends, they just shrug their shoulders. By the way, as many of them also did about Taipans being destroyed and buried. But I think it's shocking that such a gigantic amount of money is being handed over and in the process having a huge negative effect on our defence budget, with no one even able to explain how the figure was calculated in the first place. Anyway, I'm going to return to surface warships and the reality that the government wants the first of these general-purpose frigates to be in the water by 2029, and I'm going to remind everyone, as we have previously pointed out, that we, the Navy, could have had a 2,100-ton corvette armed with 16 vertical launch missile cells and an assortment of other weaponry from Lursen, built in Australia from 2026 onwards. That's 3 years ahead of when the first of the general purpose frigates is expected to arrive. And What really bothers me is why the offer from Lursen was ignored. Now, one of my high-level sources, and this I find so depressing, said simply, well, Navy didn't ever really take it that seriously. And one has to wonder, why on earth not? Again, I think it comes back to now this entirely inward-looking culture that exists within defence and the ADF, that they just talk to each other, that things are accepted and rejected without any sort of proper thought processes being applied. What all of this means, the accelerated delivery of the frigates to meet the 2029 deadline, is that it might be necessary to take a ship exactly as is from a parent yard, along with hardware and software that's completely unfamiliar to the Royal Australian Navy. Where the Navy has done well over the last decade is methodically standardising its surface fleet combat systems, which are now all based on a combination of Aegis, CEA radars, and a Saab 9LV tactical interface. But if in the panic to get something in the water 5 years from now, and this combination is dropped, it will be a disaster for Navy, with a hugely more expensive supply chain to manage and a far more complicated training regime to administer. And it will also make fleet-wide command and control much more difficult, because rather than having all ships with a standard fit-out, there'll be some that are just radically different. So there are two solutions to the very difficult situation that Navy has put itself in. The first is to pick up the phone to Lursen and say, hey guys, remember that interesting offer of yours to morph from the construction of Arafuras to 110-meter heavily armed corvettes? Can we still take you up on that? I assume Lursen would still be interested. Secondly, they could mandate the CA radars and 9LV for the general purpose frigates, but that's moving away from this minimum viable capability concept. Could that be done? I mean, CA radars and 9LV by 2029? Possibly, certainly if the South Koreans or Germans were doing it, but only by throwing money at it and only by getting completely out of the way of the successful contractor and just let them get on and do it. And we'll finish with a few words about Kingo Friday lunch rumours with the federal government. The federal budget, I'm sorry, only about 2 weeks away. And a strong one is that funding for the Australian Strategic Policy Institute will be cut or heavily curtailed. Now, it's peanuts in the scheme of things. I think it's less than $10 million. ASPE is a very good think tank, produces regular papers, but this government or some of the ministers are so petty that because ASPE dared blow the whistle on defence spending actually in real terms decreasing rather than increasing for the next 3 years, a few of them are out to get ASPE. It's a classic case of shooting the messenger, and I'll be watching Budget Night for that particular item with a great deal of interest, and let's just hope that I'm wrong. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time. Bye for now.
That's today's Asia Pacific Defence Reporter. For more in-depth articles, expert opinions, and exclusive interviews, visit asiapacificdefencereporter.com. Stay informed, stay ahead. This is your source for all things defence. Until next time.